You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In the past month, Somalia's capital, Mogadishu, has come under the control of Islamic militias. Many of its government ministers have resigned, and one minister was assassinated. On this week's underreported segment, we will take a look at the instability throughout Somalia. And joining me now from Baidoa, Somalia, is Rob Crilly. He's reporting on the situation for the Christian Science Monitor and also the Times of London and USA Today. And from Washington, David Shin, who served as ambassador to Ethiopia from 1996 to 1999 and worked as the State Department coordinator for Somalia. He is currently teaching at the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University. I'm very pleased to welcome them both to my show today. Hello.
Hello. Pleased to join you.
Rob?
Good to be with you.
You're speaking to us from Baidoa. Is that the seat of Somalia's government?
Yes, that's right. The parliament is based here about 150 miles northwest of Mogadishu. It was seen at the time as the safest place they could meet. So, yeah, they're currently sitting in a disused grain warehouse, would you believe, in what is really a dusty provincial town of very little note beyond the fact that the parliament now sits here.
So this is a government in exile, in a sense, at least from the capital, the original capital.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I missed that. The line's not so good. Could you just repeat that?
Well, instead, how safe is it there right now?
Well, it's all relative when you deal with Somalia. I cannot travel around without an armed escort. As you mentioned, a minister was assassinated here last week, and the place is certainly awash with guns in the hands of various different militiamen. So really, for Westerners, it's a case of, and there are very few here, it's a case of staying inside your compound and really keeping your head down as much as possible.
You said there are very few Westerners there. You are reporting for the Christian Science Monitor, the Times of London, and USA Today. Is that why you are spreading yourself that thin? Or why aren't there more reporters covering the story? It's rather important, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I think Somalia is a crucial issue for this area of Africa, in the Horn of Africa here. There's a potential for a conflict that could draw in neighbours, particularly Ethiopia. And I think journalists have been trying to do their best. I have to say, the American media has done rather well with this and has had reporters coming in and out. But people stay for a few days. And because of the possible risks, people don't stay for a long time. There was a Swedish cameraman shot dead in Mogadishu only about 3 or 4 weeks ago. So people are very wary about coming in. And it's expensive. You have to pay the local militia to look after you. So I have to say, because of America's connections with Somalia, going back 12 or 13 years with the Black Hawk Down episode, the American media in particular is interested in this. But I think there is a feeling in the European media, who I also write for, that this is just, you know, another example of problems in Somalia, and haven't we heard this all before? So I think it has been a little bit overlooked in other areas of the media.
But it actually has regional implications, and it could really spread. We'll get to that later. Mogadishu fell to the Islamists a couple of weeks ago. Is there any chance that the secular warlords who've been running the country for the past 15 years or so can really challenge that hold on the city?
I don't think so. They're largely a busted flush now. They were chased out of Mogadishu, as you say, and one or two have tried to lick their wounds and regroup. But in a lot of cases, they've been forced to hand over their militias to the Islamic courts. There is one warlord, Kanyari, who is actually here in Baidoa, and there have been suggestions that he may have been meeting with the transitional government here, and there was some suggestion he may be handing over his militia to the government or working with the government. But at the moment, the government doesn't really want to touch the warlords. They've been hate figures here for some time because they have kept the country in a degree of anarchy, as you say. So I'm not sure we're going to hear from them again. One or two have gone into exile, and one or two have disappeared into the depths of the country to lick their wounds for the time being.
David Shin, hasn't the Bush administration been providing funds to the warlords? Is that because they see them as the secular alternative?
Well, there certainly seems to be considerable evidence to that effect. I believe that is all stopped now. It was a policy that did not work, and those are the warlords that have been, in effect, chased out of Mogadishu.
And they're also the warlords that were involved in the fighting that most Americans associate with Black Hawk Down.
Well, some of them were and some of them weren't. It was a very mixed group of warlords, but you're absolutely right. A few of them were involved in the attacks against American and United Nations forces back in 1993.
So do you think it's wise for the United States to get involved in this situation, or are there other ways we might get involved that don't provide funds to people that we probably don't want to be connected with?
Well, we certainly should not be funding any of the warlords. That was a failed policy, in my view. On the other hand, there are ways to get involved that I think can be positive. Over the short term, the immediate task, as difficult as it is going to be, is to encourage the very weak transitional federal government that's located in Baidoa, where Rob is, to meet with the Islamic court representatives in Khartoum under the aegis of the Sudanese government. Sudan is currently the chair of the Arab League. And there was one, actually, successful meeting several weeks ago in Khartoum where the two sides met and reached a very basic outline of a way to try to bring some peace to the area. But unfortunately, all the subsequent meetings that were proposed have not occurred. And both sides, at one time or another, have said they will not participate in a further meeting. And it's very murky now as to whether that meeting is going to happen or not.
Now, you mentioned the Council of Islamic Courts, also called the Union of Islamic Courts, the Islamic Courts Union. I guess it's how you translate the words from Somali. But these are the Islamists who have been gaining power in Somalia in recent times. How long have they been around?
Well, Somalia became a failed state. That is, the last recognized national government came to an end in 1991. The Islamic courts actually started building up their power in the very early 1990s, and they have had a control of some sections of Mogadishu for quite a number of years. They're not new at all, but it's only been in the last several months when they were confronted by the last of the warlords in Mogadishu, where they have seized control of all of Mogadishu, have now expanded their control to what is known as Greater Mogadishu or the Benadir area, and then have gone beyond that as far as the lower Shabelle River to the south and well to the west, nearing Baidoa, and up north as far as Afgau and perhaps a little further north. So they probably control at least 20% of Somalia now, maybe a little bit more, but they're mainly following a clan line.
Is this at all similar to what we saw in Afghanistan after the Soviets left? First, we had warlords fighting for control of the country, and then in came the Taliban, who are a fundamentalist Islamic group.
Although there are a few similarities, in my view, there are more differences than there are similarities with what happened in Afghanistan. The whole clan structure is more important in Somalia than a similar type of movement was in Afghanistan. You also have, in the court structure, moderates and extremists. And to the extent that the moderates, and I believe they form a majority, can regain control of the organization, what they are likely to do may not be all bad. The problem is if the extremists capture control, and if they manage to do that, then the outcome could be very unfortunate for Western interests and perhaps for Somalis generally. But it's just too early to say who is going to gain control of this movement.
I'm a bit confused. We have a Council of Islamic Courts, but you're really saying it could just as easily be called a council of various clans?
It's at this point largely based on one clan, the Hawiya clan. Now, there are five major clans in Somalia, and up to this point, the Islamic courts have extended their power along the geographical areas where the Hawiya live. Now, the Hawiya are also broken down into subclans and sub-subclans, and you probably don't want to get into that, but the other four major clans, although they do have a few representatives among the court structure, have not yet fallen in behind the movement.
Rob, what role do the clans play in the accepted government of Somalia, the one that is going through all these problems now where you are?
Yeah, well, the whole point of the transitional government was to try and bring the clans together. So they came up with a principle of the 4.5 representation, meaning that the four major clans and a minor clan were supposed to be all given a degree of representation within the parliament and within the government. So you have a situation where the president comes from one of the major clans, the Darod, and he picked a prime minister who comes from the Hawiya, again, the clan represented within the Islamic Courts Union. And this prime minister was picked specifically because his clan was the leading clan in Mogadishu. So there have been a number of attempts by those within the government, within the parliament, to make sure that all the different clans were represented and had a say in what was going on. We now appear to be seeing something of a fracture along those clan lines within the government. The prime minister's position at the moment is particularly under threat, because if the transitional government is ever going to negotiate with the Islamic courts, then they have to have something to offer the Islamic courts. And the thing that the courts would like is a major position within the government. And at the moment, the courts, the Hawiya clan, are represented by the prime minister. So you could easily see the courts saying, well, we would like that Hawiya position. We want to see one of our people as the prime minister. So although attempts have been made to try and overcome this clan issue by making sure they're all represented, really, this clan issue is something that could still cause major divisions within the government.
And the Prime Minister, Ali Mohamed Gedi, announced the postponement of talks with the Islamists on Tuesday. Is that a bad sign?
Yes, I think it's a hugely bad sign. I mean, I think on the one hand, he's aware that his own position will be under threat. And at the same time, what it has done, he said this a number of times. He's been seen as one of the people standing in the way of talks. And every time he has voiced his opposition to talks, he has prompted a flurry of resignations from the government.
And is that
so
what happened?
Currently at a position. Sorry.
I was going to say, and is that why these cabinet ministers resigned this week?
That's right. The cabinet ministers are saying that they now see the prime minister as a sticking point. He is dragging his feet over talks, they say. So I think we've had two more ministers go today, and we're up to something like 36. And at the moment, the people I'm speaking to within government are saying there's no problem, there's no crisis, but they're not really very far away from some sort of constitutional crisis. So I think if we can get talks underway soon, that might placate some of the ministers who've resigned, but it's not looking very good at the moment.
What's the story behind the recent assassination of the Minister for Federal and Constitutional Affairs?
Well, that was the question I was hoping you weren't going to ask, because that, as far as I can tell, is anybody's guess. I've had people telling me that the Islamists are behind it. I've had people telling me that this minister was close to the prime minister, and therefore he was seen as another sticking point to talks. I've had other people telling me that, no, this minister was in favor of talks. So really, although I think one person has been taken into custody and the government tells me they're making good progress with investigations, I don't think we really know the motive behind it. And it's just another example of Somali's very murky politics in action.
Although riots broke out in the city after he was killed, was he popular?
Well, he was certainly an important figure within the government. He'd been a former speaker of a previous attempt to set up a parliament, and he was seen as one of the political heavyweights within the government. So I must admit, I'm not entirely sure where he's from. I can't remember whether he was a local politician, but certainly the shooting did provoke a degree of anger on the streets, and it brought out a lot of people who were in favor of some sort of resumption of peace talks.
What about President Abdullahi Youssef Ahmed? Is he popular?
Well, this is where the clan politics come into action. He's from the northeast of Somalia. He's been a military strongman in his time. He was the president of his area in Puntland. So he has a stronghold of power up in one area Somalia. And he is also very close to Ethiopia. Ethiopian troops have fought alongside his own troops in the past. Now, the minute you involve Ethiopia, that brings a whole load of other baggage with it. And the fact that he is close to Ethiopia makes a lot of people here very suspicious of him. Ethiopia is thought to have territorial ambitions over Somalia. Somalia and Ethiopia have been to war in the past. So although he has a stronghold of support, I wouldn't say he is broadly popular beyond his clan.
And we will get to that in just a moment, because with us is not only the man who was just talking, Rob Crilly, who is reporting on the situation in Somalia for the Christian Science Monitor, also the Times of London and USA Today. He's in Baidoa, Somalia, but also David Shin, who served as the ambassador to Ethiopia from 1996 to 1999, also worked as the State Department coordinator for Somalia. We'll continue our conversation after this. We're talking about the current crisis situation in Somalia with David Shin, who was ambassador to Ethiopia from 1996 to 1999 and worked as the State Department coordinator for Somalia. He's also now teaching at the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University. And from Baidoa, Somalia, we're talking with Rob Crilly, who is covering the situation for the Christian Science Monitor, also the Times of London, and USA Today. If Prime Minister Ali Mohamed Gedi is so weak, has so little power, why is he resisting talks?
First, there is a divergence of opinion in the transitional national government about these talks. The current Speaker of Parliament in the TFG actually is in favor of going forward with talks. So there are elements of the TFG that favor talks. There are other elements, like the Prime Minister, that do not. And why he does not favor the talks, frankly, it's not totally clear to me. I would also just point out that there are 102 ministers and junior ministers in the transitional federal government. So if the number that has left or been fired is now 36, that means that more than a third of the entire cabinet is no longer there. If I could just make one clarification, I thought I heard Rob Crilly indicate that Ethiopia had territorial ambitions against Ethiopia. If I heard that correctly, it's really the other way around. There is what is called the Greater Somalia Movement that goes all the way back to Somali independence. They have a five-pointed blue star. Each point of that star represents a geographical piece of territory that they wanted to reincorporate into Somalia. It's all part of Somali irredentism, and one of those stars represents the Ogaden and the Haut of Ethiopia, which is about one quarter, maybe one fifth of all of Ethiopian territory. The other points are for Somali land, Somalia, and the northeastern frontier district of Kenya and Djibouti, which has a very large Somali population.
In the mid-1990s, Somali Islamists, who called themselves the Unity of Islam, conducted attacks in Ethiopia. Are they still active today?
There's a group in the Ogaden area of Ethiopia called the Ogadeni National Liberation Front, which is very active and which is receiving some support, probably both from Somalia itself. It's a little unclear whether it's from the court structure or not, but it could be. And I've also seen reports that they've been receiving assistance from Eritrea, which has another interest in all of this.
Now, Eritrea used to be a part of Ethiopia, and it gained its independence only fairly recently when totalitarian regime was overthrown a few years back. But then it's been involved in a war with Ethiopia over some minor territory, as I understand it. What do they have to do with all of this
in
Somalia?
This gets very complex. And basically, Eritrea received de facto independence in 1991, de jure independence in 1993, and then war broke out along the Eritrean-Ethiopian border in May of 1998. That war has ended. There was effectively a military victory for Ethiopia. But the problem has never gone away. There was binding arbitration to demarcate that border, and the place where it all began is a little town called Badame, which the Ethiopians claim, but also the Eritreans claim. And in binding arbitration, that went to the Eritreans, and that has been the sticking point ever since. The issues are far more complex than that. Ethiopia is a landlocked country. It wants access to the sea. There are economic problems between the two countries, and you get very involved. But the way it plays out in Somalia is that, according to the United Nations, there has been military support going from Eritrea into Somalia in support of the Islamic courts, basically serving as a surrogate for Eritrea. Now, at the same time, you have Ethiopian troops, I don't know what the numbers are, that are also operating inside Somalia and are working on behalf of the transitional federal government. So, in effect, the Eritrean-Ethiopian conflict is also playing out to some extent in Somalia.
And the Somalian transitional government has accused Eritrea of sending arms to the Islamists.
Yes, that's what I just indicated. Yeah. And I think there is evidence to support that. At least that is what the United Nations report said that came out last May.
So the irony of the whole thing is that Sudan has been taking up the role as peacemaker.
Yes, and it is very ironical indeed. And they're playing that role largely because they currently chair the Arab League, and the initial talks that took place between the transitional federal government based in Baidoa, where Rob is, and the Islamic courts, who are based effectively out of Mogadishu, met in Khartoum under the authority of the Arab League, which means that the Sudanese chaired the meeting. Sudan has also had a long-time interest in Somalia and has had in the past some fairly close ties with the Islamic courts. So one wonders what all is going on there in terms of Sudanese interests.
But it's kind of odd. We have this Greater Somalia movement, which envisions a Greater Somalia that would incorporate Ethiopia and Djibouti and perhaps Eritrea. And
no,
then
not,
we
not Eritrea.
Okay, those other places. And at the same time, you get the feeling that Somalia has become a proxy war for some of those countries.
To some extent, that's oversimplifying a bit, because on the one hand, Ethiopia is backing the transitional federal government, but the transitional federal government doesn't have any real military capability, so they can't really serve as a proxy for Ethiopia. If Ethiopia is going to have a role in Somalia, it's going to have to do it by itself, not trying to operate through the TFG, which just doesn't have the capacity.
My guests are David Shin, who served as ambassador to Ethiopia from 1996 to 1999, and also served as the State Department's coordinator for Somalia. And he's talking to us from Washington, where he teaches at George Washington University. And we're also talking with Rob Crilly, who is right now in Baidoa, Somalia, which is the seat of the transitional government. The government that's under great attack these days. He is covering the story for the Christian Science Monitor and also the Times of London and USA Today. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So, Rob, what is the current situation? It seems likely that the transitional federated government is going to fall sometime in the near future. Go ahead.
Go on, sorry. No, I hate to stick my neck out on anything to do with Somalia, because things can change so very quickly. 2 weeks ago, I would have said we were all-out conflict, but the two sides have moved back from that position. But I think the government now it is in its worst position, the worst position it's been in since it was formed in 2004. It won't take many more resignations to leave the Prime Minister so isolated that we end up with some sort of constitutional crisis here. And the only good news, I mean, the very latest news that I have from Baidoa is that the Speaker is actually putting together a delegation of MPs to travel to Khartoum to make some sort of attempt at restarting peace talks. The only question is, though, to what extent do they represent the government? It is the Speaker acting rather than the Prime Minister, whose job it should be to be doing this. But there may be some prospect for talks to resume. I understand the Islamists are also keen to talk. But, of course, the whole thing may now be hindered by what's happening in Lebanon. The Arab League, who are mediating the talks, have, quite frankly, have got other things to worry about. So there are some. If you want to be optimistic, there are one or two good signs. We're not as close to the brink as I would have said we were 2 weeks ago. But I think the government is in a very dire situation.
You think it's likely that we'll see an Islamic government in Somalia? Would that bring stability? I mentioned the Taliban later, and even although that comparison was generally rejected, you get the feeling that that might happen, that this group might bring a stability to a country that hasn't been stable now since, what, 1990, 1991? I think if something's happening with the line. What do you say, David?
You could very probably have a government that is called Islamic, which is based on Sharia. The question is not so much whether they implement Sharia. There are many Islamic governments around the world that do that. The question is, what kind of Sharia is it? And there are all different varieties of Sharia. I think the debate that's probably going on within the Islamic courts is how they would implement the Sharia, and to what extent would there still be a secular face on an administration. And that's where the real arguments are going to take place. I think that there is a good prospect that you can have out of all of this a fair amount of secularism in a government yet. The Somalis are not inherently fundamentalist. They believe in an Islam that has a lot of Sufism in it, and although there are some who are educated in Saudi Arabia, they have links with the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, and they have become very fundamentalist. They're a very small minority at this point, and the question becomes, who is going to ultimately lead all of this effort?
But Rob, there have been reports that the movie theaters have been closed down in Mogadishu because they're too un-Islamic.
That's right. I mean, there have been some. There have been a number of rather hardline moves by the Sharia courts. Five rapists were sentenced to death by stoning some weeks ago. When I was in Mogadishu 6 weeks ago, the waiter at the hotel where I was staying told me that they'd been banned from having live music at weddings. There were reports that the Soccer World Cup wasn't allowed to be screened at movie theatres. So I think there are a lot of moderates within the movement, and it's dominated by moderates. There are extremists within the movement. And I think somehow the government here or the international community really ought to try and engage with the moderates and to try and sideline the extremists so that we can harness some of the good things that have come out of the Islamic courts. When I was in Mogadishu, so many people told me that they could walk around the streets at night, which they hadn't been able to do. The roadblocks had been dismantled. People felt safe and secure for the first time in 15 years. It's just a case of whether those good things can be salvaged from one or two of the slightly more unsavory aspects of Sharia law.
David, in early June, Osama bin Laden released an audio tape denouncing the interim government. And there's a man named Hassan Dahir Awais who seems to be connected with the Council of Islamic Courts, who also has connections to al-Qaeda.
Hassan Dahir Awais is an extremist. There's no doubt about it, and there are several others. Awais was affiliated with a one-time terrorist group, Al-Ittihad al-Islamiyah, which was based in Somalia, carried out terrorist attacks against Ethiopia. And that connection cannot be denied. The links between al-Qaeda are much fuzzier. There probably has been communication. There probably has been some contact. But the fact is that I suspect very strongly that al-Qaeda is trying to take advantage of this situation. And when al-Qaeda made that announcement, it was basically rejected by some key members of the Islamic courts. So I'm not sure the al-Qaeda connection is all that strong yet. On the other hand, the United States has said that the three of the terrorists involved in the bombings of the U.S. embassies in Dar es Salaam and Nairobi in 1998 took refuge in Somalia. And there's some evidence to support that that happened. Whether they're still there or not is highly questionable. But if they did go to Somalia, then someone obviously was protecting them, and that's a very unhealthy situation.
Well, Rob, Somalia is close to Yemen and the southern part of the Arabian Peninsula, so it seems like a natural option as a hideout for al-Qaeda operatives.
Yeah, the fact that there has been no functioning central government for 15 years means it's very easy for people to move around undetected. As I come in and out of the country, I don't have my passport stamped. So there are advantages. Yemen is only a boat ride away, and it's a journey done by thousands and thousands of people every year. So this is really the fear that Somalia, as a failed state, really could be a gateway to Africa for Al Qaeda or elements that want to use it. But I tend to agree with David Chin that I think sometimes the links with Al Qaeda and the links to international terrorism are really rather overplayed.
I want to thank you both so much for participating in today's underreported segment, in which we've been looking at the unstable situation in Somalia, guaranteed to continue to be a real problem. We've been talking with Rob Crilly, who is reporting on the situation for the Christian Science Monitor, the Times of London, and USA Today, and with David Chin, former ambassador to Ethiopia and also State Department coordinator for Somalia, currently teaching at the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, and honored.
Great, thank you.